With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Secrets and Spies presents Espresso Martini with Chris Carr and Matt Fulton.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to Espresso Martini. Now, Matt, you are, well, you've got the lurgy at the moment. Are you okay?
I'm good. I've never heard that one before. I'm good. It's been coming on all week yesterday.
Oh, no.
Yesterday was a little rough. I'm fine though. It's just a little head cold. It's not got tested. It's not the thing that I think if I said the name of it this early in the episode, YouTube would put like a banner below us. It's not that.
Okay. It's not the C word.
No, it's not that. I know. I always like. I don't know. Whenever I get these things, I go through this pattern of like first thing in the morning, I like yearn for death, and then like 2 hours later, like I'm fine. You know. So it's just hard to get.
Sorry to hear that. Yeah, it's that time of year, sadly. I'm sure I'll come down with something in the next few months. But yeah, it's always some cold or some flu or something. So
biggest thing yesterday was my eyes. My eyes were all like red and screwed up, and so I looked like I was on something that I wasn't. I should come on an episode and be like, "Yo, man, did you hear about this war in the Middle East, bruh?"
Like it. Yeah, I guess it might be a sinus thing if your eyes are affected, but yeah.
Yeah.
But from my WebMD experience, but there we go. So on today's show, it's a bit of a different show today. So first of all, we're going to chat very briefly about Robert Redford, who passed away. We're going to look at our first story, which is the war on American intelligence. Then we have a little segment. So there's an event called Spy Q that's coming up in October. And I sat down with Gavin Stone and his colleague James to chat about Spy Q. So you'll hear more about that after the first ad break. And then we will be wrapping up with our final story, which will be a nice cheery one about Israel bombing Hamas in Qatar. We always like to pick the cheery ones. So
that's what we do here.
That's what we do. So first of all, we'll just chat about Robert Redford. So, you know, I'm sure almost everybody by now knows that Robert Redford passed away at the age of 89. You know, he had an amazing career. And for me personally, I'm a huge fan of the film Spy Game, as many people will know listening to this podcast. And if you don't know that, then, you know, that's the fact. And I think his portrayal of Nathan Muir is a big reason why I love that film. Muir is the quintessential spy master, a man who can outthink everybody in the room, manipulate events behind the scenes, and pull off a rescue mission by turning the CIA's bureaucracy inside out. And what I love about Redford's performance is how he plays Muir, both as charming and quietly ruthless, and he's sort of a mentor to Brad Pitt's character, but he's also sort of, in a way, playing God. He's deciding who lives and who gets burned and what truths get buried. And that moral ambiguity is kind of at the heart of espionage storytelling and of that film in particular. And that's probably why I like it so much. Out of all the mainstream movies about espionage, for me, Spy Game is the one that kind of just goes through the eras of the CIA from the sort of Vietnam through to the early 90s. And it's definitely written by somebody who knows what they're talking about, which is Michael Frost Beckner. And it's directed by, and we did an interview with him. And it's directed by Tony Scott, who's the brother of Ridley Scott. And it's an amazing film. So anybody who hasn't seen it, you should check it out. As you should check out, you know, Sneakers, which is another great film. And and obviously 3 Days of the Condor. So Matt, I don't know if you had any thoughts on Robert Redford, any films that stood out for you?
Amazing actor, amazing career. I mean, yeah, so many you've named. Did wonderful work with the Sundance Film Festival, started that. He was always the actor that, like, when I was... She'll laugh when she hears this. She was the actor that always, like, when I was little, like, my mom would have left my dad for him. That was always the guy that you better watch out for. But sad to see him go. But yeah, amazing life, amazing career.
Yeah, no, indeed. So rest in peace, Robert Redford. What a loss to us all here. But he's left an amazing legacy, both on screen and behind the scenes of the Sundance Institute and other environmental causes and so on. So, we'll have a look at our first story today, which is about the War on American Intelligence by Matthew Saville, and it's for RUSI, which is the Royal Services Institute. So in his thought piece, he says that the US intelligence community is under attack from within. Since the start of Trump's second term, the heads of major agencies like the DIA and NSA have been forced out, along with senior figures at the NIC and FBI. Security clearances have been stripped from career officers, and units focused on election interference and foreign influence have been dismantled. The result is a sweeping purge that many see as an unprecedented move in American history. The administration claims that these actions are about cleansing intelligence of political bias tied to what they call the Russian collusion hoax. But declassified evidence hasn't disproved the 2016 assessment of the Russian election interference. Instead, critics argue this campaign looks more like revenge against analysts and officials whose works challenge Trump's narrative rather than a genuine attempt at reform. This internal turmoil has major global ripple effects. The US is the backbone of the Five Eyes Intelligence Alliance, and losing experienced analysts, especially on Russia and emerging technologies like AI, will reduce the quality of intelligence available to allies. The second Trump administration has shown a greater willingness to retaliate against assessments it doesn't like. In one case, analysis on Venezuelan criminal gangs was rejected, and officials were pushed out of the National Intelligence Council after refusing to rewrite their findings. Trump's skepticism about Russian interference is well known, and if this pressure shapes what intelligence is collected or how it is assessed, vital threats like disinformation, election interference, and counterintelligence could be deprioritized. That would leave both the US and its partners dangerously exposed, stripping away protections against threats to their democratic systems. The UK is uniquely exposed because it relies heavily on US intelligence for satellite imagery, geospatial data, and signals intelligence. With Washington leaking more and politicizing analysis, British sources and methods could be compromised. Experts argue that the UK may need to limit what it shares on the most sensitive issues and invest in its own independent intelligence capabilities to reduce its reliance on the US. There is no quick fix for this crisis. Allies have survived previous shocks, from the Cambridge spies to the Snowden leaks, and the intelligence relationship between the UK and US has eventually recovered. But right now, partners need to be pragmatic, protect their own interests, and manage the risks carefully until Washington stabilizes. In other words, hope is not a strategy. So Matt, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, this is a story we've covered before in the last few months, and I'm certain we'll cover it again in the years to come. We're in it now, you know, clock is ticking down. I think we have to keep moving forward. I don't know that anyone's really looking to me for advice, but if I had to give some, I would say, what I hope would be done, triage for now, you know, do what you must. Protect your sources and methods where you feel it's warranted, you know, especially human sources, and also take it as an opportunity to develop new capabilities that may have atrophied since the Cold War. You know, on this show, I've always welcomed the UK and our other partners becoming less reliant on the US for their defense. And again, not because I don't value that relationship and want it to continue, but because, you know, doing so, whether that's intelligence capabilities or defense infrastructure across Europe, you know, doing so would make our alliance all the more formidable in the future when there are hopefully happier days to come, you know? So I would again, I think if it's the same pattern of advice I've tried to thread through this whole thing is to just eyes on the ball, focus, think beyond 3.5 years, you know. And of course, yeah, warrants some changes and everything. And I think it could be an opportunity for real good here, especially in terms of, you know, building up UK and other European, Australia partners' capabilities. You know, there's also like Klaus Fuchs, British representative on the Manhattan Project, was a Soviet spy. So this sort of back and forth, it's a happens in partnerships. This is just a particularly rocky patch.
Yeah, peaks and troughs, it happens. Mm-hmm. I do find it interesting that there are some arguing for the UK to have an independent capability to replace what the US currently provides, but I doubt that's going to be financially viable for any UK sitting government.
On SIGINT?
Yeah, on SIGINT. I think human intelligence, we've kind of got that covered. We've got a good mm-hmm. history of it, et cetera. Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there are longer than we have.
Yeah, but there are challenges because the world is changing with biometric data, et cetera. It's getting harder and harder. So we are probably going to become more and more reliant on electronic means. Obviously, the new head of MI6 is from an electronics background. She was the former Q, so to speak. And so I'm sure, you know, we are thinking of ways to innovate and to be able to sort of fill in some gaps. But I think the idea that we'll come our own completely independent capability, I think, is unrealistic.
It's physically difficult because it means so much of the Five Eyes infrastructure is physical infrastructure interconnected in this globe spanning network. You know, you can't just separate it. And to your point, extremely cost prohibitive to just mimic or get close to mimicking that kind of capability on your own. And then, you know, to that point, you know, the time period it would take to do such a thing would put us far outside when this should be done.
Yeah, indeed. Now, I mean, obviously the UK could seek closer ties of European partners and possibly mm-hmm. develop new capabilities with them. But again, there are no easy answers with that route because obviously financially it could make sense to split the cost of this new capability of European allies. But Europe is far from immune from the politics that is driving the current Trump administration. Same with the UK. We're not immune to it either. You know, we do face the risk of a Trump-style government with the rise of Nigel Farage and his Reform Party. And if he were to become Prime Minister, he could cause havoc with MI5, MI6 and GCHQ in the UK with politicised reforms. And his support for NATO and Ukraine has, has been in doubt just as much as it has been with Trump. So, you know, there's no easy answers here. I don't think even our own independent capability, whether it's a European one or an in-house one, just being purely British, will necessarily protect us from the politics that's driving a lot of this sort of upheaval at the moment. Now, I did mention the last episode, I think it was the last episode or the episode before, I think it was the last episode, Gordon Carrera, who's a former BBC security correspondent, now host of The Rest Is Classified, reported that British intelligence chiefs are spooked by the politicization of intelligence in the US. And he claims intelligence chiefs are currently putting on a brave face behind closed doors, and there's a genuine concern about the reliability of American partners. And one concern that has come up is the publishing of sensitive information by officials in the Trump administration for political gains, with little regard for the sensitivity of the content. The CIA release of a report into Russian interference in the 2016 election reportedly contained highly sensitive information for the British within that report, and many people are not happy about it.
Mm-hmm.
He also reports that when America's Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, accused former national security officials of a treasonous conspiracy, it caused a lot of discomfort in the UK intelligence community and made it significantly harder to pretend that there was nothing to see. I think this Roosie piece is one of the first sort of indirect published expressions of this anxiety, because obviously Roosie is a highly respected think tank. It's 190 years old. And for them to publish a piece about this, to me, strikes me as a kind of indirect way of expressing what's being said behind closed doors.
Yeah. When you picked this in the outline, I started reading it and was surprised it was from Roosie. Some of the language there was new. Hadn't seen that from them before.
No, indeed. Because we've seen, obviously, quite a lot of headlines in the Guardian, Observer, mm-hmm. and various other newspapers sort of saying similar things. And we've talked about this even in the last season as well. So this is not necessarily new, but the fact that Russia publishing it is new and of note.
Yeah, Russia's a think tank, not a news outlet.
No, exactly. So if they're saying it, there must be something. Mm-hmm. People are not happy. That's what's going on.
Yeah.
So. So I hope, obviously, the professionals inside the US and UK intelligence are doing everything they can to navigate this moment. But 8 months into President Trump's second term, the cracks are clearly starting to show, which is very unfortunate. So, yeah. Is there anything else you'd like to add? Or
No. I'm sure we will be back on this again at some point.
Yeah, I think we will, unfortunately. Right, well, I'll take us into our first break, and then when we return, we will be having a chat with James and Gavin Stone about their Spy Q event. So join us after the break. Gavin and James, welcome to the podcast. How are you both doing?
I'm good, thank you.
Really well, Chris, thank you.
So you both are holding a really interesting event that I think would be of interest to our listeners called Spy Q. So I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about this event and what inspired you to create it.
Spy Q is an event that we're doing in October on the 27th and 28th. And what we've done, we've taken intelligence officer training from all the world's best agencies. So you've got MI6, CIA, Mossad, all the others. And we've condensed this psychological training given to intelligence officers down to what can be used by civilians. We've taken out all the flash and the bang, and we're going to be able to give people the kind of mental resilience and influence training that intelligence officers receive to give them a massive advantage to absolutely anything they do in life. There's a varied background of this, both from people in the intelligence community who've advised me to do this, but a lot of it came, believe it or not, from my wife, when I'd be getting phone calls regularly with people saying, hey, I've got this problem, or I need to sort that. And she sat there one day and said, look, instead of having people ring you up to solve problems all the time, why don't you teach them the methodology you've been taught to think how you think and allow them to solve their own problems? And that was kind of the birth of the concept, as it were. Looking at great idea. That's
fantastic. A bit like teach a man to fish and then he'll always be able to catch something.
Exactly that, yeah.
Yeah. So before we get into details of the event, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background? I open that to both you and James.
Yeah, I'm happy to kick off, Chris. So officially, I am still working on the books. I'm almost signed off complete, and so I can't and wouldn't want to officially say anything on record now. I mean, what I will say, what I think you might find interesting and your listeners might find interesting, is if someone was to publicly say that they worked for MI6, there would be no law against them doing that. But if someone did work for MI6, they would be punished if they did ever share that they worked for MI6. So it's quite an interesting thing to notice for any of your future guests. If they publicly share that they did work for such agency, stands a chance they may not have.
Interesting.
Yeah, there are ways of saying it without saying it. Mm. And, you know, I know you've had some of my friends on in the past who have been former MI6, and what you'll generally hear a lot of people say is something along the lines of, I'm former British intelligence, or I'm a former intelligence operative, or whatever the case may be. So, so my background is I'm former British intelligence. and I've actually spent most of my career as a contractor, more so than working directly for the government. Mm. So I've had the best of both worlds. I've officially been on the books for the Ministry of Defence, but also I've gone down the other route of working as a contractor for several different allied governments. And that has been a really great experience, because I've got to learn and make friends with people in the intelligence community and see training on both sides of the fence and how different agencies work.
Thank you for that. So your press release about SpyQ calls this a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. So what makes SpyQ different from other sort of personal development and leadership trainings?
What makes SpyQ very different from other offerings out there is, where else, first of all, in the world would you find former intelligence officers, former military intelligence, and others in a room in Dorset in the UK giving away tradecraft to civilians? Where else in the world would that happen? That's the first thing to say. Gavin?
Yeah, this is something that has been put together, and we've literally taken the best of the best from, you know, all the leading agencies. You've seen the alphabet spaghetti of different three-letter agencies that are involved here. But we've also got, you know, special forces, we've got military intelligence, we've got counter-terrorism guys, we've got a good old mix of people that are all going to be serving their part in teaching each and every section of this to the audience that are there. And more importantly, this being the first UK event, we also don't know if we're going to be able to put another one on. even though we've got permission, they may turn around at some point and say, yeah, now we've took a closer look at it, we might put an end to this. So this might be their only chance to be able to cash in.
Is there a risk of undercover attendees suddenly shutting it down?
I would say that is a safe assumption, that there will definitely be somebody. Well, I know for a fact there's going to be somebody there from the government, but whether or not they will put the brakes on it. They won't probably at the event, but they might stop future events.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, fantastic. Sounds very intriguing. Do you think there could be a risk of, some undercover Russians or something in there too?
No. So I've got a KGB friend that's actually helping with the small section, hopefully no undercover Russians. We got the experts there to help us out with that, if there are.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, what kind of sort of techniques and exercises do you think people are going to be able to sort of learn from this event? Can you give us a sort of flavor of what kind of experience they will be having?
One of the many areas that we're going to cover is the power of insider information. And I don't know if you're familiar with a game called the Werewolf game. Have I ever told you about it?
No, I don't think I did. Yeah.
So this was invented by a Russian tactician, believe it or not, and it's to demonstrate the power of insider knowledge. And I have used this with everything from military recruits on the actual army base where this is taking place, right up to intelligence operatives. And what you do is you get around about 30 people to sit in a circle. And when I use the army recruits, what I generally do is I get them to put their beret in front of their face to ensure that there's no cheating. And I'll go around and I will tap four, maybe sometimes six people on the shoulder. And I will tell them, if you've just received a tap on the shoulder, you're a werewolf. If you haven't, you're a villager. If you're a werewolf, take your beret down and look at who the other werewolves are. And then what they do is they take their beret down and I'll say, now what I want you to do is pick two villagers to kill. And they pick two villagers to kill. I say, now, everybody put your berets back on your face. And when I tell you, I want you to all remove your berets, the two people who've been killed will be removed from the circle. And I want you all between you to figure out who the werewolves are. And I watch this time and time again play out exactly the same. The circle gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until eventually all the villagers are killed. And there's only the werewolves remaining. Mm. And that demonstrates the power of insider information. That's a summarized version of it. And that in itself, it gives you an idea of not just how powerful this insider information is, but we're also going to teach you how to be able to get access to that insider information.
And you mentioned sort of techniques from the CIA, MI6 and Mossad and even the KGB. So how do you translate that intelligence training, which is often sort of classified and mission specific for potentially, you know, everyday civilians who might be coming to this event as well as insiders?
So, apart from mental resilience and kind of extreme influence skills, there's a lot about the strategic thinking side of things and just being able to view things from a slightly different angle. And this goes from everything from people to situations. And I'm going to hand over to James now. He's he's going to talk a little bit about profiling and as well as influence.
Yeah, so some of the, if you think about some of the tradecraft that we will be discussing over the 2 days, it's highly, highly powerful in everyday civilian life. And if you think about in the business world, walking into a room and you have some information that you need to discuss with a group of people, knowing full well that you need, by the end of that meeting, to get them all on side and leave that room with a positive outcome, maybe securing funding, maybe it's a promotion that you want. All of this stuff is highly transferable. So some of the things that we'll be talking about over the 2 days, the first thing is elicitation. So that's a method used by tradecraft to CIA, other agencies around the world, to gather information. So we'll talk about elicitation. That simply is making statements to garner information rather than asking questions. And the more, the key thing there is, the more sensitive the information you need, the less questions you should actually ask, which sounds counterintuitive, but that's elicitation. And I won't give away the game today because come to the event, but there are some really powerful statements you can make to garner information. Next, deception detection. So someone on this has written a book on deception detection, but you're in that room and you've made a statement and you're looking for little cues of glances over the room for who's looking at who. Then someone's asking you a question, deliberately pointed question, and you're now engaging in conversation. How can you be sure that their intent is pure and say you're listening between the lines there? So that's deception detection. And then we've got methods around enhanced influence. And again, that's a big subject that we'll be covering in great depth over the 2 days, because there's influence techniques and then there's enhanced influence, both of which we'll be covering. And there's a hugely powerful tradecraft secret that we'll teach, and I will share that today, which is called positive association. And positive association is where we want someone to behave in a particular way. So what we will do is we will offer up some of the traits that we want them to behave in, with things that, with ideas and identities that we know they will find appealing. So a business person will like the idea of work ethic and great timekeeping and professionalism. And we will attach the things that we want. So we want them to be really open and we want them to be able to connect with us in a much deeper way. So the people that have great work ethic and great professionalism, guess what? They're also very open and they're able to connect. And it's a hugely powerful, believe it or not, powerful tactic used to influence someone. So these are just some of the many tradecraft secrets that we'll be sharing that would be highly potent and powerful in all walks of life in the civilian world.
I will quickly add that, you know, if you look at what effectively intelligence officers, or what's sometimes known as spies, what they do for a living, they go to a foreign country and convince a complete stranger to go against their very ethics and moral code, betray the country they live in, and risk everything, including sometimes their life or possibly life imprisonment, for very little reward most of the time. So if you can look at those kind of abilities that we're trained in to be able to do that, and you look at how that is transferable to everything from sales, and business, that gives you an idea of, you know, the kind of toolbox people are going to be able to have their to their advantage when they leave this two-day event. Mm.
Who is this event really designed for? Is it just for executives and entrepreneurs, or can anyone benefit from this training?
Go back to an early question, which is, why did we set the business up? Both Gavin and I have had multiple clients through the years where, and also just friends and family members who have come to us for advice. Mm. And they are genuinely from all walks of life. So we're talking about people in the emergency services, say, working in hospitals, working in schools, someone who is starting out their career first, and also someone who runs a FTSE 100 business. And the skills that we teach are for all walks of life. So it isn't just for what one would think a professional working in the city. This is genuinely for all walks of life. If your listeners are someone who wants more from life, wants a step up in the career, wants to start a business, perhaps wants to improve their relationship with their kids, that's also a reason to attend the event. Deeper relationships. Wants to find, maybe feels like there's something more from life and maybe be a part of something, because Spike U isn't just an event. It's actually a community that we're building and of like-minded individuals who want to leave people better than they find them, who want to improve themselves and others. So that's really the types of people that we would love to come to the event. Gav?
Yeah, I think you've pretty much got that covered there. Yeah, so you know, it will just put people from any position they are in and give them a roadmap to get to where they want to go. And not only that, but it'll also help them identify where they want to go. Some people don't know, they just know that the life they've got isn't necessarily what they want.
And how are these sort of 2 days structured? Is it just like sit down seminars, or are attendees going to be actively participating and practicing these skills?
There's a bit of all sorts with it. So we've got guest speakers and trainers, as you know, from all over the world, from different agencies and governments and countries and so on and so forth, that some are just going to speak about their experience and how from their experience you can learn. Others, one for example is a friend of mine who is former military intelligence. He's going to be teaching some more of the practical stuff. Two of the topics covered. Number one is how to remember the name of everybody you meet, which is hugely advantageous. Yeah, so many people could. So that's going to be one of the things that he covers. But more importantly, what he's going to do, because this gentleman has been in the Guinness World Book of Records twice for memorizing the random order of 10 decks of cards, so 520 cards. And then on the second time, it was either 12 or 13 decks of cards. Wow. So he is a memory master. Yeah. So the practical applications he's going to teach from almost at the beginning is how to be able to retain all of the information that you're going to learn over those 2 days. So you're going to be learning something and instantly putting it into practice and utilizing it.
I was just thinking of, it'd be so nice if we lived in the Matrix, you could just plug in something into your head and like instantly get that skill, because memory is definitely my weakness. But I'd love to improve on that. So be keeping an eye out for that one.
Yeah, I'm going to say you'll be there, so you'll be able to take advantage of that. And that is one of, I mean, there are so many people that are going to be coming and teaching so many different skills. And that one's deliberately taught at the beginning, so you also remember all the skills you're going to learn. So you know, it's going to be very beneficial for everybody coming.
The press release talks about giving people an unfair advantage. So what sort of real world results do you expect participants to see after the event?
A real world example, I'll give you a very, very recent example. I mentioned working with clients before we started Spike U. And one of those clients will be at the event, and they're a very successful person in their field, which is in the world of procurement. And they started working with me on a particular problem they had with an executive that they worked with. And so the end, I'll start with the end result and maybe work back and tell you a little bit about how we maybe did that. But the end result was this person becoming the boss of the person they had an issue with. And in the process of that, negotiating a six-figure pay rise. So that's the end result. And to work back from that, it starts with mindset and limiting beliefs, which sounds very airy-fairy, but it starts there. And then it doesn't take as long as you think. That engagement took 3 weeks. 3 weeks, and a process then followed, and over... the following 2 months, that person was then replaced, and this person is now currently in. And for anyone wanting to come to the event, you will meet the person I'm talking about, and they will happily tell you what happened. But some of the stuff we talked about, imagine having a half an hour conversation with the right people and designing every part of that conversation in the style of the human that's doing it. So they'll work with us, and we will design a conversation for them where they will be able to leverage everything they're going to learn on the 2 days. So your listeners will be thinking about this. So they might learn some very interesting techniques on elicitation, on persuasion, on behavior profiling. They'll weave that into a half an hour conversation. Doesn't mean we're talking for half an hour. It could only be 10 minutes. But in that 10 minutes, synthesized down is highly efficacy. And at the end of it, the result follows and the process would start. So I'm being a little bit ambiguous deliberately because I don't want to give everything away. But a real world result is a former client of mine coming to the event who's negotiated a six-figure pay rise just by using, and I mean a small part of what we're teaching. And I mean a very small part.
It's powerful stuff. We've used this over the years with lots of people. And basically, this is success by design. It's something that, nothing is left to chance. It is, finding your destination and literally drawing yourself a roadmap on how to get there.
Yeah, brilliant, brilliant. And you say that audience members will leave with the mindset of an elite spy. So what does that mindset look like in day-to-day life?
It's just basically a very different approach to the majority of things that you do. And that's whether it's buying a house, finding a perfect partner, setting up a business, whatever the case may be. People tend to have a little bit of a herd mentality or go traditional routes because they don't necessarily know any other way. And I've used this thing in the past for, there's one friend who wanted to buy a house. He didn't want to put all his savings down into a house and then be, mortgaged up for the next however many years. So we use these techniques. He now has a 4-bedroom house that has effectively cost him nothing. It's unencumbered, mortgage free. And it was by the end of it all, he actually ended up making profit. I've used the same techniques for friends, whether they want to buy cars, whether they want to get a job, whether they want to travel the world. Once you change the angle of how you look at certain things, everything becomes not just a little bit easier, but has a whole different bearing on life. And that also goes for people too. You will also look at everybody you meet in a completely different way as well. But that's something that James can cover at the event.
Are you guys doing any one-on-one sessions? I feel like I could do a bit of supercharging in my life.
Yeah, we will be. In fact, I think the VIP ticket holders, I think they actually get a certain amount of coaching with as part of the package.
Oh, wow. That's cool. Well, this takes place in a secret location. Now, without giving too much away, what does that element of secrecy add to the experience?
Yeah. Okay. So, a secret location in Dorset. So I think it's fair to tell everyone it's in Dorset. And the location is deliberately chosen for a number of things. First of all, the location of where it is, many people aren't going to have ever said that they've been in this type of place ever. Not only that, once they're in this place, there are things that we've been able to do where they will never, even if they did get into as a civilian, be able to see. We've been able to unlock other things for them to experience on the day. So that's the first thing. It's really novel and it's quite exciting. The second thing to say is the purpose of coming to the event is for many people to understand information, to then use it in their everyday life to get them the outcomes they want. By doing it where we're doing it, there's research around the efficacy of learning and the retention of what we're doing. So not only are we bringing a Guinness World Record holder for memory retention, everything about this event, Gavin mentioned success by design. We have thought about everything ahead of this event, where we're doing it, the way the room will be designed, absolutely every detail has been thought through to ensure that if you come on this course, the chance of you succeeding is incredibly high post-event. Incredibly high.
Yeah.
There will be a few pleasant surprises on a positive note for people that do come along. And the reason it is being held where it is if we did this in a public domain, they would not have got or will not have been able to see some of the things that they're going to see. So, and I'll leave it at that.
Fantastic. So for someone listening right now who is intrigued but on the fence, why should they act now rather than wait?
In my time on Earth, I've met a lot of people. And the types of people that ultimately become successful in their own right. And success is by design for that individual. Success doesn't mean you have to own a yacht, right? But success could mean a beautiful family. But there's something that these people have that means they go after what they want. And often the people that are successful, if you look at it, they are able to make decisions quickly. That could be a decision which is, I don't want to do this, or I'm doing this, or I'm buying this, or I'm not buying this, or I'm not going there, but they do it quite quickly. And they use their own methods to do that. And ultimately, these people often are genuinely open to new ideas. So they use, there's a ratio that they use often, if you look into it, the neuroscience behind it. Seeking new experience versus information in the past, so their learned experience, that's how they arrive at decisions. And the sweet spot for that isn't 50-50. It's actually leaning more towards seeking new experience. Mm. They might not be sure, but they are open to it. And these, if you look at the history, all the data sets, if you read into this, and I've done more reading than I care to have done on this, but the data sets show that anyone who is successful in their life, and again, I will caveat that with, doesn't mean you need to own a yacht. It can generally be a beautiful family, right? And that's gold for many people. Their decision-making quality is very, very good, but it's how quickly they do it.
And of course, because there's a couple of things to take into account here, and that is, for anybody who's ever seen the film Yes Man, that's part and parcel of the reason that we're doing this today. And James can tell you more in depth about this one day, maybe in the bar at the event. But the thing is you know, the experiences you get by just saying yes, I'm just going to go for it. It broadens your horizons something chronic. And now is the chance, because if it is stopped, if the government or any governments decide, you're revealing too much, this might not ever be able to be done again. And if it is done again, maybe not to the exact same standards, depths or levels of what we're doing it. So rather than missing out, now is the time to take advantage.
Yeah, so in the words of Ian Fleming, say yes to adventure.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, I love that.
So finally, where can listeners go and find out more and secure their spot?
Yep, so the website is www.spyq, that's S-P-Y and the letter Q, .co.uk. And we're on all the social media, usual social media sites where you know, if you type in Spy Cube, you'll find us, and they're all very, very fresh. So yeah, there's not a massive amount of posts on there yet, but there will be more.
And listeners here, so we have, you will get a 10% discount if you book on the site. So there's a code which is Secrets and Spies 10. So it's Secrets ampersand Spies 10, and that will get you a 10% discount on any tickets that you purchase. And I will be at the event, so I'll be able to meet you in person. So it'd be nice to meet some of our listeners in the flesh at the event. So I'm very much looking forward to this. So thank you very much, guys, for joining me on the show and telling us about the event.
No problem. Thank you for having us, Chris.
Pleasure. Thanks, Chris.
So let's take another break and be right back with more. Okay, welcome back, everybody. So that was our section on Spy Q. I hope you found it interesting. Just a reminder that listeners here can get a 10% discount. You just need to type in Secrets and Spies 10 when you sign up for it. So that's Secrets ampersand Spies 10. That's the code. That'll get you 10% off if you decide to go to the Spy Q event. Full disclosure, I've got VIP access, so I will be going there and I will be there. You know, thank you to Gavin and James for inviting me, and really looking forward to it. And if anybody who does listen is going to be there, please say hello.
I am very jealous that I am stuck on the wrong side of the ocean for this. Did they do it every year?
This is their first, and this might be the only one. They're not sure. I mean, they claim that there's some stuff in there that may or may not lead to either a more sanitized version or it not happening again. But we will see. I will report back.
I would like a full debriefing very much. Thank you.
Yes. No, it should be fun. It should be fun. So our final story is about Israel bombing Hamas and Qatar. So Matt, tell us about that story.
Yeah, so I have three articles here from the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, and Axios to sort of ground us here. So I will lump it all together and explain what happened if anyone doesn't know all the details yet. So Hamas's senior political leaders gathered in Doha last week to weigh a new U.S. ceasefire proposal, Israeli hostages for Palestinian prisoners, with Washington then brokering talks to end the war when Israel struck a residential compound used by Hamas's political bureau, firing more than 10 long-range missiles from at least 15 fighters without entering Qatar's airspace. Israel immediately claimed responsibility, and Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu framed it as a doctrine shift that terrorists have, quote, no immunity anywhere. However, the Hostages and Missing Families Forum, a group representing the families of the 48 hostages still believed to be held in Gaza, expressed, quote, deep concern and grave apprehension regarding the airstrikes as it would endanger the hostages further. Israel failed to hit its targets. Hamas says its acting leader, Khalil al-Haya, and others survived, although five less senior members and a Qatari security officer were killed. The strike followed Hamas-claimed attacks that killed six Israeli civilians in Jerusalem and four IDF soldiers in Gaza. Inside Israel's security establishment, there was notable dissent about timing and method. Mossad director David Barnea opposed an assassination in Qatar, which could ruin a negotiating channel they've long provided for hostage and ceasefire talks. Mossad declined to run a ground operation it had planned, steering Israel toward an over-the-horizon airstrike. IDF Chief of Staff Lieutenant General Eyal Zamir also objected to the timing, while Strategic Affairs Minister Ron Dermer and Defense Minister Israel Katz backed Netanyahu. Qatar condemned the strike as, quote, state terrorism, but vowed at the UN to keep mediating. Washington expressed displeasure, especially because the Hamas delegation was discussing a U.S. proposal, yet there's a dispute over who knew what and when. U.S. officials say they were effectively notified only as missiles were inbound. Israeli officials told Axios Netanyahu called Trump around 50 minutes before launch and that the strike could have been halted. Either way, the window to intervene was tight. At an emergency summit in Doha on Tuesday, Arab and Islamic State leaders pledged to activate a joint defense mechanism, condemn the strike as, quote, cowardly and a violation of international law, and the Gulf Cooperation Council Secretary General called on the Trump administration to rein Israel in, saying, quote, we expect our strategic partners in the U.S. to use their influence on Israel for it to stop this behavior. They have leverage and influence over Israel, and it's about time that this leverage and influence are used. But the bottom line is, Israel launched its first ever attack on a Gulf Arab state and signaled it will target Hamas leadership even in a U.S. ally's capital. The immediate payoff is unclear, but the message is not. The price is a hit to negotiations to end the war in Gaza, almost 2 years going now, and an unprecedented stress test for U.S. and Arab patience with Israel's actions in the region. Chris, what do you think about this one?
I can understand why Israel is targeting Hamas senior leadership. Typically, this sort of operation would either see Mossad assassins sent abroad, like the 2010 assassination in Dubai, or something on the lines of Operation Wrath of God in the 1970s after the murder of Israeli athletes at the Munich Olympics. However, conducting an airstrike in a public place in Qatar, that is a new, bold, and brazen move by Netanyahu's government, which appears hell-bent on causing international outrage of each of their increasingly deadly actions. Airstrikes have obviously been used in Gaza and the West Bank in the past. I'll leave the audience to decide how they feel about those. But conducting an airstrike in Qatar on a country that's not directly at war with you does feel like a huge line has been crossed, and international law has yet again been violated. I can only assume that the reasoning behind these strikes is to A, let Hamas leadership know that they're not safe anywhere, and B, to send a message to Qatar for allowing Hamas's leadership to reside and operate there. I'm not without any doubt that many Hamas operations have been planned in safe houses in Qatar. But again, I feel like Netanyahu has pushed Israel down a path post-October 7th as actively derailing all the positive progress Israel has made in the Middle East prior to the terrible events of October the 7th. And obviously now, internationally, what Israel's doing is regarded as a genocide in Palestine, which is horrific. Yeah, I just feel like, you know, they're playing into Hamas's hands. Hamas firmly, you know, I firmly believe Hamas's goal was to disrupt the Abrahamic Accords, and Israel's response to the October 7th attacks has definitely disrupted the Abrahamic Accords, which, you know, were to help normalize relations between Israel and the Gulf states. So I think, you know, in the end, I still think Hamas are kind of winning out of all of this. So I don't know what your thoughts are on this one.
Yeah, another historical example of Israel assassinating a terrorist target in a ally's capital, a U.S. ally's capital. Also, you could look back to the assassination attempt of Hamas's, at the time, the head of their political bureau, Khaled Mashal, in 1997. Mossad, Kidan agents came up behind him outside Hamas's offices in Amman and injected like a poison into his ear.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Mashal's bodyguards captured the Kidan agents later that day. Mashal was rushed to the hospital with a headache and vomiting, slipped into a coma. And the king of Jordan, King Hussein, actually called Netanyahu, who was also prime minister at the time, and threatened to sever diplomatic relations and try the Mossad officers if Israel didn't hand over an antidote, which they did. And Mashal survived. He's since retired, I say that in quotes, as head of the political bureau, but he still has some sort of role. He was on the negotiating team and was at this compound in Qatar on the day of the strike. He, you know, survived, yeah. Of course.
Yeah.
As for the nature of Hamas's presence in Qatar, right? So this compound, it's a state-owned compound hosted by Qatari State Security, which is their intelligence service that interfaces with Hamas. So that was part of an arrangement that began originally back in 2011 with U.S. coordination and some support on funding to an extent. This is a known thing that's been, this is not new that they have an office in Hamas, that Hamas has an office in Doha, I should say. The reason was for that because there aren't previously, the Hamas political bureau was based in Tehran, right? And there was no easy, I should say, diplomatic way to negotiate with Hamas on issues where, when you need to talk to them, when it comes to, I don't know, before October 7th, deconfliction over stuff with Gaza. In this case now, the hostage crisis and ceasefire talks, right? You need to have someone who's able to talk to these people. You need to have an intermediary, and much better to have Qatar than Iran in that position. So that's why they were there. The Taliban also had an office in Doha. I don't know that they still do, but they had one during Trump's first term, negotiations on the terms for the Afghan withdrawal were handled in Doha, with the Taliban's office there. So it's I would say this is leagues more extreme than even the Khaled Mishal hit, or the one in Dubai that you mentioned. Was that 2010? Yeah.
Yeah, 2010.
Yeah. It's I think it's really interesting to me that Mossad declined to carry out a ground operation, and pretty telling. I mean, we know, especially from the last 2 years, that they're very good at what they do. And you know, so we could take a look at what that could have been. I mean, so they could be a ground operation could have involved small arms, hiding an explosive device, as seen previously with the Ismail Haniya hit at an IRGC guest house in Tehran last July, employing small drones as they have in the past. Any option, though, by the fact that Mossad executed it would have poisoned that relationship with Qatar state security. It's just a fundamental violation of that trust. This isn't good for their relationship either, but I think from Mossad's perspective, the Israeli Air Force doing the dirty work here at least makes it easier for Mossad's liaison in Doha to try to clean it up than the alternative, I think.
That's highly likely. I mean, I would say, just as a footnote, obviously when Operation Wrath of God was going on in the 70s, Mossad was definitely not as bothered by upsetting allies then.
No.
So I don't know. It's an interesting one, yeah. And also there's been rumors that we looked at about how the relationship between the Netanyahu government and the head of Mossad is not great at the moment either.
It has been strained, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. There's could be potentially, it might be the head of Mossad just doesn't want to risk his officers involved in that. I don't know, it's an interesting one.
Right. I think, you know, patiently and methodically hunting down anyone who touched October 7th is the appropriate and necessary response. Any intelligence service with the means to do so would, to restore their honor and just avenge their people. However, where I think when and where and how you do it, I think really matters. Just as I think indiscriminately flattening and then resettling all of Gaza is a disproportionate and inhumane and self-destructive response. Firing ballistic missiles at Hamas leaders in Doha while their lieutenants in Gaza still hold hostages is also wildly irresponsible and counterproductive. Instead, I think, as Mossad would agree, do the painstaking hard work to get the hostages back and the war, then go mop these guys up, you know, wait for them to leave Qatar for a third country, where doing it is more diplomatically acceptable, or if they're impatient, run an op to lure them out. Mossad has done exactly that in the past.
Yeah, they have a long memory. I mean, again, Operation Wrath of God, that went on, well, the initial operation went on the 70s, but they still got people in the 90s as well who are connected to the Munich Olympic massacre. So,
right. You know, in response to this, earlier this week, there was an emergency summit. I mentioned this in my intro. There was that emergency summit of the Arab League and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation with the Gulf Cooperation Council, the GCC, the three big Arab international organizations. They all met for an emergency summit. It was just a lot of talk, essentially, that came out of it, although I think there is some talk that is telling.
Yeah.
So, for instance, Egypt's President El-Sisi at this summit called Israel an enemy. They signed a peace treaty on the White House lawn in 1979 that was supposed to have fixed that. Poor Jimmy Carter worked his ass off for it. I think also this news was a bit unrelated to the Qatar strikes particularly, but also this week, Saudi Arabia and Pakistan announced a mutual defense agreement. So an attack on one is an attack on another. I think, whereas, you know, it was just a lot of talk coming out of that summit in the aftermath. I think, though, it would be from, you know, there were signs there that patience is not unlimited. And I don't think it's I don't think this is something that Netanyahu's government should want to test again.
No. And I can speculate on the Netanyahu government's motivations or his, but I have, you know, he is just, it just feels like he is making many, many unnecessarily provocative moves, which are going to be bad for Israel in the long run.
Can I make one more point on this?
Yeah, please. Yeah.
Netanyahu gave a speech on Monday where he talked about Israel's growing diplomatic and economic isolation following the war in Gaza and everything else that it's provoked throughout the region. And he called for Israel to adopt a, quote, super Sparta approach. So to make itself immune from international pressure, you know, like entirely self-reliant as possible. Do you know what happened to Sparta, Chris?
What happened? Yeah, it didn't really work out, did it?
No. So after their victory over Athens in the Peloponnesian War in 404 BC, Sparta was the dominant power in Greece for like 30 years. Call that period's called the Spartan hegemony.
Yep.
And in that time, they so alienated and threatened the other major city-states that they formed a coalition backed by the Persian Empire, oddly enough, to defeat Sparta, which Thebes eventually did at the Battle of Leuctra in 371. Defeat Sparta never recovered from. So I, you know, suggest Sparta is maybe not a model Netanyahu should seek to emulate here.
No, isolationism never works out, especially in a interconnected world.
Belligerent isolationism, especially.
Yeah, indeed, indeed.
In that neighborhood.
And it should be, should be a warning to all. It seems to be a growing trend at the moment. But it never really works out when you look at it through history.
Also, that summit in Doha, where Egypt's president called Israel an enemy, came on the fifth anniversary of the signing of the Abraham Accords, were meant to, of course, normalize diplomatic relations between Israel and the Arabs. And a key goal of Hamas and Iran behind the October 7th attacks was to sabotage that normalization. So I make of that what you will.
Yeah, well, it's it. I think every disproportionate response, if you want to put it politely, that Israel commits makes Hamas, it gives Hamas, a stronger footing in many respects, and it helps them achieve what their goal was, which was to isolate Israel and to make sure that Israel it doesn't normalize any relations with the Arab world. And that seems to be working right now.
And we were close, making real progress. A genuine signature achievement of Trump's first term of his presidency. Of like, yeah, this is pretty good that they pulled this off, and this is what's happening now 5 years later.
Yeah, and you don't really get much sense that Trump is trying to preserve his legacy over this one either. You know, it was pretty historic, the Abrahamic Accords, and you know, he just seems to be kind of going along with it.
Yeah, he's getting pulled in a lot of different directions right now. I wonder how much he's tapped into it. But
yeah, be good to know. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add, or are you happy though?
No. Really wish I could be in Dorset next month. I don't know. Yes. Maybe next year in Dorset. We'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hopefully. Well, we'll definitely. Hopefully there'll be some more interesting things. Just talking about the road ahead. So I've been making a concerted effort to reach out to a lot of museums and institutions. And so we might be getting a few more specials over the months ahead. There's a really interesting exhibition about John Le Carre's writing coming up in Oxford. And I'm chatting with the Bodleian Library about that. I've got the Imperial War Museum. I've got some things going on. So yeah, some very exciting things kind of coming up.
The Le Carre one is like another one. I'm like gnawing on the bars of my cell. Like,
well, hopefully the video content and interview that I managed to conduct around that might help mitigate some of that, but yeah. Or make it worse. I don't
sure.
know. Cool. Well, thank you very much, everybody, for listening. I hope you all have a great weekend, and thank you, Matt, for your time today, and I hope you feel better in the few days ahead. I hope you get a speedy recovery over the weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Take care. We'll catch you on the next one. Bye for now.
Take care.
Thanks for listening. This is Secrets and Spies.